Well, hello to you all. I'd like to add my own welcome, whether you are near or far. Thank you, Ricky. Thank you for your admonishment to stillness in our crazy world, our manic existence. Thank you so much to the team, the tech team, Tony and Paul this week who have put the service together. Please keep your Bibles open today at Job 31 because we shall be returning to the text a few times. If you haven't been with us so far, or if you have, but your memory isn't quite what it used to be, here's a quick summary of where we have got to on our journey with Job. We were introduced to Job in chapter 1 as a man who is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Satan, the accuser, arrives on the scene and basically claims the only reason Job loves and fears God is because God has blessed him and protected him. And if that protection were to be withdrawn, Satan is sure Job will curse God. No, no, says God. Job is faithful. And because God is so sure of his faithfulness, he effectively allows Satan to do his worst and to reduce him to the pain and grief-racked misery that we see him in. But do not despair. Relief is at hand. Job's three mates arrive on the scene to console him. Sadly, though, after an amazing start, sitting silently with him on the ash heap for a week, when they hear him protest his innocence, they cannot hold back from passing judgment on him. And their judgment is this: God is just, and what is known as the retribution principle rules in the world. In other words, good is rewarded, bad is punished. Well, Job, you are obviously being punished, therefore you must be bad. You must have sinned. Another quick observation on this book. Commentators have noted that the whole drama is set out like a courtroom scene. I don't know if any of you have ever been in court. It's quite a scary place to be, quite an intimidating place to be. You have the accuser there, Satan. You have the accused, the man in the dock, Job. You have God as the judge. And you have a cross-examination process going on with his friends as they basically insist he has sinned and try and get him to admit it. And so we come to this chapter, chapter 31, which is essentially Job's closing statement, his final defense. And the chapter, you will have just recalled, finishes with the words of Job are ended. Or to put that in our courtroom parlance today, probably I rest my case. So to start with today, let us remind ourselves of some of those claims of Job's, astounding claims in chapter 31. He claims to have lived in personal purity. Verse 1, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman. And verse 9, if my heart had been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let them grind, and then let them make my wife grind out another man's grain, and may other men sleep with her. Whoa! Job claims to have lived a deceit-free existence. Verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood or my foot has hurried after deceit, let God weigh me in honest scales, and he will know that I am blameless. He claims to have shared with the underprivileged and adopted the needy. Verse 16 to 18, if I denied the desires of the poor or let the eyes of the widow grow weary, if I've kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless. He claims not to have abused his position of power and influence. Verse 21, if I've raised my hand against the fatherless, knowing that I had influence in court, then let my arm fall from my shoulder. He claims not to have trusted in his wealth. Verse 24 and 25, if I've put my trust in gold or have said to my gold, you're my security, if I've rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands have gained, he claims not to have turned to idols. Verse 26 and 27, if I regarded the sun in its radiance or the moon moving in splendor so that my heart was secretly enticed and my hand offered them a kiss of homage, then these also would have been sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. He claims not to have rejoiced in his enemy's misfortune. Verse 29, we're nearly there. He claims to have not allowed his mouth to sin by invoking a curse against their life. Verse 30. He claims not to have nursed secret sin in his heart. Verse 33. And finally, he even claims to have looked after the environment, the land and its workers. Verse 38 to 40. Now, I don't know how you respond to those claims. To our ears, I think they're pretty extraordinary. Extraordinary claims, aren't they? Extraordinary for a number of reasons. Firstly, this is not the sort of behaviour, sadly, that we've come to expect from our leaders, our national leaders, our civic leaders, even sadly, perhaps our church leaders. Instead of integrity, how often do we hear of leaders caught with their hands in the till, or taking backhanders, or raiding pension funds, or paying workers a pittance whilst earning a fortune for themselves, or fiddling their expenses? Instead of fidelity or purity, how often do we hear of extramarital affairs? How often do we hear of politicians or business leaders using their privileged positions to feather their own nests or to gain an unfair advantage? How often do we see our newspapers gleefully exposing leaders or politicians or celebrities caught in some secret sin? These are extraordinary claims, secondly, because when you look at other characters and leaders in the Bible, in amongst their faith and their courage and their love for God, you see some pretty glaring examples of sin. Abraham, for example, attempting to deceive others into believing his wife was his sister. Moses, murdering an Egyptian that he saw mistreating a fellow Hebrew. David, making off with his friend Uriah's wife and then having him killed. Solomon's lust being unsatisfied by his 300 wives and somehow needing to have a further 700 concubines. To no one's surprise, that particular proclivity led him to take part in the worship of other gods. This a mighty man of the Bible. They sound like extraordinary claims, thirdly, because they seem to be at odds with other scriptures that we read. For example, Jeremiah 2, in Jeremiah 2, the nation of Israel is claiming in verse 35, I'm innocent. He's not angry with me, he being God. And God replies, but I will pass judgment on you because you say, I have not sinned. A few verses later in chapter 3, we come to a very familiar charge. Only acknowledge your guilt. You have rebelled against the Lord your God. And that is a theme that goes on and on so many times through Scripture. God just wanting his people to fess up and admit their wrongdoing and turn. In 1 John chapter 1, in verses 8 to 10, that's 1 John chapter 1, verses 8 to 10, if we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we claim we have not sinned, we make him, God, out to be a liar, and his word is not in us. So come on, Job, get real, just fess up. Fourthly, they seem to me to be extraordinary claims because we tend to view life through our own lens, don't we? When I honestly look at myself, I'm acutely aware of my sinfulness. Brennan Manning, in his Ragamuffin Gospel, writes this: honesty is such a precious commodity that is seldom found in the world or the church. Honesty requires the truthfulness to admit the attachment and addictions that control our attention, dominate our consciousness, and function as false gods. I can be addicted to vodka or to being nice, to marijuana or being loved, to cocaine or to being right, to gambling or relationships, to golf or gossiping. Perhaps my addiction is food, performance, money, popularity, power, revenge, reading, television, tobacco, weight or winning. When we give anything more priority than we give to God, we commit idolatry. Thus, we all commit idolatry countless times every day. Those are strong words, but for me, there is so much of me in there. And because that is my life experience, when I hear Job's claims, I want to join his three mates in challenging and rubbishing his claims and judging and condemning him. It reminds me a bit of the movie Airplane. Some of you oldies might remember that film, when the passengers are lining up to slap the hysterical woman and tell her to pull herself together. It's a funny scene. I feel like joining that queue with Job. Come on, Job, get real, fess up. Job's claims seem so at odds with all of these things. So we have a problem. And it turns out that it is our problem, because regardless of the conduct of the leaders of Job's times, or indeed of other biblical times, and regardless of the conduct of our leaders and celebrities today, and regardless of my behavioural standards, Job is blameless. Not only blameless in his own eyes, which is all his three friends think that he is, but blameless in God's eyes too. Job chapter 1 verse 8 says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Those are God's words. The Pharisees of Jesus' day would claim righteousness, would parade devotion and flaunt rule-keeping, but Jesus condemned them as hypocrites. When we hear Job claiming righteousness, maybe we instinctively line him up with the Pharisees and think that he's part of that same hypocrisy. But that is not Job. Astounding as it seems, astounding to us perhaps with our standards, astounding when we compare him with others, he is innocent. God himself describes him as blameless. And so you think about Job's predicament. Struggled so hard to do the right thing, struggled so hard to be upright and to be God-fearing, and then to be accused, and then even accused by his best friends. It's a horrible place to be in, being accused unjustly. I don't know if you saw a news article that came out in the last few days, where hundreds and hundreds of sub-post office managers were convicted over a period of years of fraud, of cooking the books. And it turned out years later, when their lives had been thrown into complete turmoil, and they'd been ashamed, they'd been sacked and in some cases sent to prison, it turned out that it was all down to a faulty computer program which was literally making money disappear. I sense perhaps when I saw that article, a few lawyers rubbing their hands together with litigation opportunities there. But for years, those people were tarnished unfairly. They were judged unfairly. Being hauled up in court and even sent to prison for something that you're entirely innocent of is gruesome. We, of course, have the story of Joseph in Genesis. So if any of you feel strongly that is you at the moment, go to Joseph and his story, because wonderfully, good comes out of it in the end. Job is innocent, God declares, but of course that doesn't mean that he never sinned. That mantle belongs to Jesus alone. Job was a standout man in his generation. God said there was no one on the earth like him at that time. Abraham was a standout moment in his generation. One man who became a nation and through whom all nations are blessed. But of course we know he was a sinner. We spoke of his sin earlier. David was described as a man after God's own heart, but that didn't stop him from falling into sin's snare himself. So what, brothers, sisters, friends, does Job's actual innocence and his very real suffering say to us today? I'd like to highlight two things. I'd like to leave us with two things that I think we need to learn from this today. The first is not to be so quick to rush into judgment. It was uncomfortable for me to realise how quick I was to line up with Job's accusers, how quickly I form an opinion and judge by my own standards. It reminded me, as I wrestle with this and question of it, when I first got into work, I worked as a salesman. I was not a good salesman. I was not an energetic salesman. My heart wasn't in it. I really wanted to be doing other things. And in the sales office that we worked at, there were others who were a bit like me and others who were motivated and top sellers. And it was very compelling because all of the guys who were not very serious tended to herd together. And those that went you know, off chasing the targets, were a breed set apart. And we would always be together because I think we felt more comfortable together in our situation. If we were on our own, that would have been even more uncomfortable. As we were herded together a little bit, we felt a little bit better about our own failings and our own shortcomings. I wonder if that speaks to you. It also reminded me of when I was at school, standing outside the headmaster's office, as I sadly was on quite a number of occasions. I always felt better if there were others along there with me, going to be lined up as well. Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 7 not to judge. And he warns us, if we judge, the same measure that we judge others with will be what is how we are judged. So it's not just about not doing the wrong thing because it'll reflect on us. It's about trying to do the right thing as Jesus tells us. Secondly, you may, like Job, be upright, a faithful servant of God, or at least striving to be. But does that mean because of that you're going to have a trouble-free existence? I don't think so. In Job chapter 1, Satan asked God to afflict Job. And that, of course, opens up a whole theological can, interaction between God and Satan. But we're not going to go there today. But it's not actually a one-off. In Luke chapter 22, verse 31, Jesus says to Simon Peter, his right-hand guy, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you," that's all of the disciples, "as wheat." It happened in Old Testament times. Job was not immune from trouble. It happened in New Testament times. Jesus' disciples were not immune. Should we really think that we will be immune today? No. We know we too have troubles. We heard Emma share a few weeks ago of the Leggett's terrible troubles. Maybe you've lost a loved one recently. Maybe you're wrestling with that sort of grief. Maybe you've been a faithful husband or wife and have had your spouse walk out on you. Maybe you've been a faithful employee but are now staring at the possibility of redundancy. No, our faith and commitment to Christ does not mean that we won't have troubles. We know we will. We have an enemy, an accuser. He was there to accuse Job. He was there to accuse Jesus' disciples. He's here to accuse us today. We are in a fight, and our challenge is exactly the same as Job's. In the midst of our pain and our dismay, to somehow own these words, which are found in James chapter 1, verse 12. "Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him." May we be able to say those words. In conclusion, this morning, the commentator Warren Wiersbe writes this in his commentary. I'd like to close with this today. "Review Job's oath and you will discover that he has asked God to send some terrible judgments if he is guilty of any of these sins. Others will eat his harvest and uproot his crops. His wife will become another man's servant and mistress. His arm will fall from his shoulder. His harvest will be weeds and thistles. He made it clear that he was willing to face the righteous judgment of God along with these other judgments. When the words of Job were ended, everyone sat in silence, wondering what would happen next. Would God send immediate judgment and prove Job guilty? Or would he accept Job's challenge, appear to him, and give Job opportunity to defend himself? Perhaps God would speak from heaven and answer Job's questions. Job had challenged God because he was sure God would vindicate him. Job's three friends were sure God would condemn him. What will God do? The answer may surprise you." Over to you, Ricky.